About 2,300 years ago, the great philosopher Aristotle finished a work that he called Nicomachean Ethics. It was his attempt to write down the guidelines for how human beings can live their best, most virtuous lives. And virtuous actions, he believed, created virtuous people. We become just by doing just acts, Aristotle wrote, temperate by doing temperate acts, brave by doing brave acts. Okay, so fast forward to 1926 when the great American philosopher and historian Will Durant published a book that is still highly influential. It's called The Story of Philosophy. Durant was a huge fan of Aristotle, and this was how he summed up Aristotle's theory that virtue comes from repeated virtuous acts. And I quote, "We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit," close quote. So, now that we have absorbed this wisdom of the ages, let us step back for a moment and consider, in that light, one of life's greatest pleasures. Bacon. Bacon is divine. I love it. The smell of it in the morning is a call to family, a call to love, a call to the common table. Most everyone I know loves bacon. Now, I have met a few folks who say they don't like bacon, but they all make me nervous. I never cared much about which brand of bacon was on my breakfast plate. Then one night, about 15 years ago, at a fine restaurant in Atlanta, I discovered the one true bacon. Bacon so singularly delicious that I came to think of it in the grandest of terms. Tasting it was like holding J.R.R. Tolkien's Ring of Power in your hand, or Excalibur, the sword of King Arthur, or Poseidon's trident. It was the one bacon to rule them all. It was God's own bacon. Now, the dining establishment where I experienced this was called Restaurant Eugene, and it was run by one of the South's most celebrated chefs, Linton Hopkins. I was on one of my earliest dates with Stacy, the woman who is now my wife. We were eating dinner, not breakfast, so there were no strips of bacon on our plates. Instead, we were eating a soup. I believe it was a corn chowder of some sort that had small pieces of bacon in it. And the waiter explained what was in the soup when he served it. Then he waited for us to taste it. There was bacon in my first spoonful. And when I bit into it, angels sang. "Where," I asked the waiter, "did this bacon come from? It's amazing." "That is Benton's bacon," he said. "It's made in Tennessee. And specifically, it is made in a little town called Madisonville in East Tennessee, about halfway between Chattanooga and Knoxville. And it has been made there for more than 40 years now by a man named Alan Benton." Mr. Benton is soft-spoken, neither physically imposing nor arrogant in any way. But I believe, and I say this with no hyperbole intended, that Alan Benton is the Aristotle of bacon. The bacon and country hams he smokes in Madisonville are the product of four decades of virtuous repetition, continuous learning, and small improvements along the way. Earlier this year, about 15 years after Stacy and I first experienced Benton's bacon, we finally headed up to Madisonville to see how the magic happens, and we decided to take y'all with us. This episode gonna make you hungry. Today, on Salvation South Deluxe, we're going to tell you a story about family and striving for greatness, preserving a legacy, and coming home, and bacon. The best damn bacon in the world. I'm your host, Chuck Reese, and Salvation South Deluxe is a series of in-depth pieces that we add to our regular podcast feed. We try to unravel, in a deluxe way, some untold stories of the Southern experience, and let you meet some authentic Southerners, people who make this region truly unique. few miles north of Madisonville on U.S. Highway 411, you will see a large sign with an arrow that says Country Ham pointing at a cinder block building. On the side of the building, in huge letters, it says Benton's Smoky Mountain Country Hams. We cure 'em. You couldn't really refer to the whole building, which is quite large, as a smokehouse. But when you walk in the front door, you are overwhelmed with the aroma of smoked pork. If you are a lover of country ham or bacon, the place smells like heaven should smell. If you don't know what I mean when I say country ham, a country ham is dry cured in a mix of spices, then it spends time in a smokehouse, then it's aged for 6 months or longer. It's a method that's been passed down for centuries in Appalachia, a way to preserve meat before the days of refrigeration. And it was passed down to Alan Benton. Your granddaddy cured hams, is that right?
Both sides of the family, both sets of grandparents. They lived a mile apart in the hills of southwestern Virginia. 25 miles, I guess, from the nearest town. And they were sustenance farmers in the purest sense. They literally raised everything they had.
Talking to Alan Benton in the small office where he's answered the phone and taken orders for his hams and bacon for decades, listening to his stories, I am reminded of my oldest uncle, Efford Reese, about whom I have told you a couple of stories on this very podcast. Uncle Efford, or Papaw as I called him, raised his own hogs and made his own country hams every year in a smokehouse. And the folks in my family love to get some of his country ham every year.
They took great pride in it. It was almost bragging rights as to who'd made the best bacon or the best country ham that far in the world.
I can imagine that.
They didn't have much to feel good about, but they took pride in that.
In 1947, Alan's grandfather, Albert Hicks, started what is now Benton's Bacon.
Albert had a business between Madisonville and Sweetwater on Old Highway 68. Wasn't government inspected, just a little hole in the wall smokehouse behind his house, but he cured ham and bacon and sold it to people who came by. And he started in that business in 1947. And he ran it till the spring of 1973.
Alan helped his grandpa out in the smokehouse all throughout his youth. Then he moved up the road to Knoxville to enroll in the University of Tennessee. Enrollment was through the roof back then because so many young men wanted school deferments to save them from the draft and keep them out of the war in Vietnam. As a result, dorm rooms and meals in the cafeterias were hard to come by.
You couldn't get on a meal plan. You could hardly ever get into a dormitory. And when I finally got in the dorm, couldn't get on a meal plan. And I tired rather quickly of hamburgers. After about a quarter, I had enough hamburgers. And I started just carrying country ham back to my dorm room, frying it in the pan.
Which is how he learned that the smell of country ham will make you friends.
You could draw a real crowd about 10 o'clock at night frying country ham in the dormitory. They come out of the woodwork trying to find that over.
But Alan didn't plan on getting into the smoked meat business after college. After graduating from UT, he headed to Middle Tennessee State University for a graduate degree with the goal of becoming a teacher.
I taught school for a year down in Brevard County, Florida, near Cape Canaveral. Again, I got hungry for home cooking, and I'd call my dad. He'd go over and pick a ham up from Albert Hicks and send it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd carry a country ham sandwich into work, and people say, "Oh, my goodness, where did you get that? Can you get me a ham office?" And I'd come home and carry back three or four or five hams at a time to people that I went to school with.
But it wasn't long until Alan figured out the teacher's life wasn't for him.
I figured out I was never going to be able to make a living teaching school. Pay was terrible. And I thought about maybe going to law school with my plan. But after I quit, reality set in. I thought, you know, I'm going to have to sit out a year, maybe 2 years to get into law school. What am I going to do in the meantime?
And about that same time, Alan's grandpa, Albert Hicks, started thinking about retirement plans.
My grandparents were getting old and not able to fool with the hogs.
So Alan got a new idea.
So I went over and talked to him and talked him into leasing me the little building in his backyard. And that's where I started making Alan Butcher.
Is he the one who taught you the method?
I knew what we were doing at home, Chuck, but I wanted to learn more about what I was doing.
I didn't ask Alan Benton if he studied Aristotle in college, but this was definitely the moment when he started thinking in an Aristotelian way, as they say.
I immediately wrote letters to schools all over the South, University of Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, Virginia, anybody that I thought could help enlighten me, because I made my mind up, if I was going to do this, I wanted to do it really well.
His earlier studies at UT never caused him to cross paths with agriculture professors.
The first time I went up to that ag campus, within 15 minutes, it was like this epiphany moment. It was like a breath of fresh air. I thought, oh my gosh, if I'd only known it was like this on this ag campus. It's a totally different atmosphere. It was an incredible experience.
Smoking meat, putting up hams and bacon for the winter, had always been like folklore, methods and wisdom passed down from generation to generation. That's what Albert Hicks had given his grandson. But Alan dove straight into learning the science behind those old school methods and how, just maybe, to improve them.
Albert was old school. He was an incredible man, brilliant guy. But he was thoroughbred old school. Always wore a hat, as gentlemen of his era did, and usually had a cigar in his mouth. Usually wasn't even lit. He just wallowed around. And
Albert was an old school guy of the sort who believes that those who can, they do, and those who can't, they teach.
He looked at me one day. He said, "Boy, you fool with them educated fools, you'll soon be out of business." Well, I knew that they weren't exactly educated fools. And I followed their advice to the letter. I hung my hat on every word that they spoke. And I solved this problem that he never did understand.
The problem was spoilage. The way Albert did things, not every ham he hung up to age wound up being edible.
And I got on a first-name basis with a lot of the people, a lot of the professors in the food technology department up there. And I immediately started talking about the spoilage problem he had, and I figured out why he was losing meat with the help of those professors. Remember, I was young and wet behind the ears, but I started out wanting to make country ham and bacon as good as anybody in the world was making it. The Chinese, the Europeans, anybody. I wanted to do it as well as anybody.
There's an old saying that goes, fast, cheap, good. Pick any two. Now, Alan Benton continuously improved his methods for 8 years, and his bacon and hams tasted better and better. But the folks who were okay with fast and cheap smoked pork were getting the business. Alan was aging his country hams for 15 months before he sold them. They tasted divine, but he had competitors who were aging their hams for the bare minimum of 3 months.
And if somebody was 3 or 4 cents cheaper per pound than I was, they'd buy their ham instead of mine. I was starving to death in this business.
After a whole decade of learning and improvement, Alan was about to give up on his dedication to quality. But then his daddy gave him a talking to.
My dad, an old World War II guy, and he was sitting on that bench out front. And man, I was barely hanging on. I built this place, and I was, not have been 10 years after I started, but somewhere in that time frame. I walked up, he was sitting there, and I said, "I think I may have to speed up my curing process like my competitors." He looked up and he said, "Son, if you play the other guy's game, you always lose." He said, "Make the product the best you know how, no matter how expensive the process. And he said, sooner or later, quality will sustain in this business. I swallowed every word he said, hook, line, and sinker, because I knew he was right, and I never looked back.
I bet you're thinking this is the point in the story where something unexpected and wonderful happens.
And I was troubled for another 15 years after that.
When we come back, we'll tell you the story of how Alan Benton survived that long, rough patch. Not only did he survive, but he became so successful that a couple of years ago, his son Daryl decided to leave his job as a doctor, a radiologist, to enter the family meat business. You're listening to Salvation South Deluxe. When we left Alan Benton before the break, he was describing how, after his father convinced him to stick with that dedication to quality, he faced 15 more years of struggle. Which brings the Benton story into the early 1990s. Around that time, about an hour northeast of Madisonville, in a little community called Walland, the Bell family was expanding the little six-room country inn they had operated since the late 70s into a full-scale resort. A world-class, high-end resort called Blackberry Farm. In 92, the Bells hired a young North Carolinian named John Fleer to be Blackberry Farm's executive chef. Fleer was freshly graduated from the Culinary Institute of America in upstate New York. Fleer and the Bell family wanted the food they served to be grown, raised, and prepared right there in the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee. Their resort sits on 4,200 acres, and they farm that land, growing their own crops and raising their own livestock. They wanted to serve the very best of local products, regardless of their cost. Chef Fleer discovered Benton's Bacon in nearby Madisonville and began incorporating Allen's products into the Blackberry Farm menus. Then Fleer recommended Benton's to another chef, a friend in New York City whose name you will know. That is, you will know it if you have ever watched the TV show Top Chef. Tom Colicchio, the show's head judge for all of its 22 seasons. Colicchio ran the kitchens at two legendary Manhattan restaurants, first Gramercy Tavern and then Kraft. When Colicchio called up Benton's to place his first order, Allen was ecstatic.
I had three employees, and I bounced all over the buildings really excited. I said, you guys won't believe this, but I've just taken the work from this guy in New York City. He probably doesn't know what he's getting, probably never buy anything else, but at least we can brag and say we shipped it. 3 weeks to the day from when I sent him his first order, I was selling to seven restaurants in New York City.
And just like that, this humble smokehouse in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains had traveled all the way to the Big Apple and had entered the world of fine dining. Back at Quillen College of Medicine, where Alan's son Daryl was studying, his dad's phone calls were bringing exciting news, not only about the new customers, but also the national food magazines that were wanting to write about Benton's.
I don't think I realized kind of the exposure that his products had gotten and the following that they'd gotten just because I wasn't as closely involved with the business at that point.
Yeah.
You know, my parents would send me a link or send me a copy of a magazine that had been in. So I started to get an idea, but of course I was always proud to see that kind of stuff.
As it turned out, that was only the beginning. Word about Benton's Bacon and Country Hams was spreading among young chefs who had big aspirations in New York City.
One of them was a young chef who had actually been working for Tom. He walked in and smelled them preparing that first order, the first shipment I sent up there. And he said, what in the world is that aroma? and he went straight to the phone on the desk at Kraft and placed his first order with me, David Chang.
David Chang is the Korean-American celebrity chef who rose to prominence with his Momofuku restaurant group and three different shows on Netflix. The late chef Anthony Bourdain, on his PBS show Mind of a Chef, had Chang talk about Benton's bacon.
When I first tasted Alan Benton's bacon, it was one of those experiences where it was like a first-time experience. You're like, wait a second. What have I been doing? What have I been eating my whole life? This is the real thing. This was a just a punch me in the mouth type of experience. It's extraordinarily smoky and it's salty. It just tastes like what bacon should be.
David Chang turned out to be one of the most important proponents of Benton's bacon.
I probably picked up 500 accounts because I sold to David Chang. I would get a phone call and somebody would say, hello, my name's so-and-so, I'm a chef in Dallas or Seattle or wherever they're from. And I was in New York over the weekend. I knew what was coming next. I ate with David Chang, can you sell me this product? And I literally couldn't repay David if I tried.
So here was Alan Benton, suddenly selling his products to some of the most elite fine dining chefs in the world. But Alan and his wife, Sharon, had never themselves actually sat down to one of those chefs' meals.
I didn't know for sure what a fine dining restaurant was until John Fleer invited Sharon and me up for a meal at Blackberry Farm. Some guests had asked to meet us, and he'd said, I want you to come up and have a meal with us. Someone will show you what we're doing to product. That was my first fine dining experience. He served scallops and a bacon consomme. I can close my eyes and still remember the texture and the flavor of that meat. It was amazing.
It's now about a quarter century since Benton's Smoky Mountain Country Hams stopped struggling to stay open. These days, every week, Benton's goes through 400 to 600 hams. And the pork bellies from which they make bacon? Benton's buys between 10 and 14,000 pounds of pork belly every week. Benton's now ships its bacon to restaurants and home cooks everywhere, plus two varieties of country ham, one aged for 15 months after curing and smoking, the other aged for more than 2 years, which puts them in the league of delicacies like Parma, Italy's prosciutto, or Spain's jamón ibérico. But you will not find Benton's products at your local supermarket. To keep the level of quality high, Benton's can't increase its output enough to supply the giant supermarket chains.
We've stayed away from it intentionally. We don't want to pick up an account and not be able to do business in the proper way. And we're too small, we think, to try to do business with supermarkets. We've turned down some of the big name stores out there in the supermarket world because we feel like that's not who we are. There's about four big grocery store chains that come to mind real quickly that begged for it for a while. I don't hear from them anymore. I think they finally gave up.
It takes a lot of confidence to say no to a major grocery store contract like Alan Benton has had to do many times over the years. Alan's son, Daryl, remembers the rough days when he was growing up and nobody outside East Tennessee knew about his father's products.
It was a struggle to survive and keep the lights on in here. He was working 7 days a week, long hours. That was pretty much my whole childhood, and I saw very little of him. And it was hard work. You know, around the holidays, we'd be out here till midnight slicing bacon, making sausage, doing anything we could to survive in the business. When I was in high school, I'll tell you, nobody had ever heard of us. We were just selling to local folks here. I'd have to come out here and work after school. And back then, it wasn't too cool to go out on a date Friday night smelling like smoked bacon.
In those days, Alan wasn't thinking much about bringing his children into the family business.
My parents, I mean, we were encouraged to find a better way of life. It didn't seem like a viable option long term. I felt called into the medical field, went to medical school, did a residency in radiology and a fellowship after that, and practiced medicine for about 7 years.
Were you one of those mountain kids like me who thought he wanted to get out of living in the country and do something bigger?
No, I didn't necessarily want to get out of the country. Country's in my blood, but, you know, I grew up working in this business. You know, from the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I was out here labeling packs of ham and bacon. Those first 30 or so years that my dad was in the business.
But when Darryl was up the road in Knoxville, making great money practicing medicine, he found himself dreaming not of expanding his radiology practice. Instead, he dreamed about bacon.
I missed this work. It's in my blood. You know, I'd be at the hospital and, you know, you start getting thoughts of that smoke rolling out of the smokehouse and loading the wood stove, the sights, the smells, the people. I tried to shake it off, kind of get on that educational track. I got to the next step and then the next step. But it's something that I couldn't get out of my blood. So finally couldn't ignore it any longer. Hung up my white coat, went from curing people back to curing bacon. And I'm the happiest that I've been in a long time.
Called me heartburn at first. I thought he had it made as a boxer.
I called him, Chuck, and told him that I'd let my group, I was a partner in a private practice up in Knoxville, and I let him know that I was going to be leaving to come back here. He said, "Son, what have you done? You make good money. You've got all this vacation time." He said, "I've been in business for 50 years, and I've taken one or two vacations. Are you sure?" After I'd been down here for about 6 months, he saw how happy I was. I mean, I drive to work smiling every day and drive home the same way. And I think now he knows how much happier I am, and I think he's glad I made the switch too.
Do any of your old doctor friends tell you that you're an idiot?
No, they tell me they're jealous.
Once you're inside the front door of the Benton's building in Madisonville, all you see is a shopping area. There is a butcher counter with refrigerated meats, a cooler with some refrigerated goods, and some baskets filled with vacuum-sealed packages of bacon and slices from country hams. But if you go through the back door of that lobby area, you see where, and I'm sorry about this, but I just can't resist saying it, where the sausage gets made. The process with the hams and with the pork belly slabs that become bacon begins with curing. That means they get rubbed with seasonings. For the hams, it's a simple mixture of salt, brown sugar, black pepper, and red pepper.
Now I'm forced to use sodium nitrite on a country ham. USDA requires a salt content of 10%. There is no such requirement on the bacon. So our bacon is made only using salt and brown sugar, exactly like my grandparents did.
And after the meat has had time to absorb the seasonings, it is hung on racks with wheels and rolled into the smokehouse, which is actually one large sealed room in the building into which smoke from a hickory wood fire that literally never goes out is piped. Stacy and I stand for just a moment in front of the smokehouse doors as Darryl opens them. The smoke is so thick you can barely see the meat hanging inside. After the prescribed time absorbing that smoke, the hams and pork bellies go into various aging rooms that are maintained at various temperatures to match the cycles of nature. The Benton's reputation today is such that they do take on some custom smoking jobs for certain chefs. In the first aging room, Alan and Darryl point out a certain whole ham hanging on a rack. Attached to it is a paper tag that shows a date in 2023 and the name Sean Brock. Sean Brock, of course, is one of the most prominent chefs in the South, the winner of multiple James Beard Awards, who first made his name with his restaurant Husk in Charleston. Brock now runs three restaurants in Nashville, Joyland, Audrey, and June. Alan tells us that Brock's ham comes from an Ossabaw Island pig. Ossabaws are a breed native to the Georgia Islands. Direct descendants of pigs that were brought to the Americas by Spanish explorers in the 1500s. And their meat is prized for its dark color and rich marbling, which makes them perfect for curing, smoking, and aging. Which is why Sean Brock brought his prized ham to the Bentons. Alan says he'll keep the ham on the rack until Brock is ready to come get it. Now, the fuss that such chefs make over the traditional Appalachian methods of the Bentons still surprises them.
Growing up, we just ate country ham bacon with traditional Appalachian food, beans, greens. So I'd never really been exposed to much fine dining. Growing up, times were lean, as we've talked about.
One of Darryl's earliest exposures to what high-end chefs could do with his father's products came when he was still in medical school.
I was in medical school up in Johnson City, and my dad called me. He said he was going to a dinner at a restaurant called the Townhouse in Virginia. Sean Brock was, coming in to do a special dinner there, and Dad had been invited because they were featuring his products, and he let me tag along. He said, "I think you need to come and check this out." I had never been exposed to any food like that in my life. And I remember it.
It's still one of the top five meals I've ever had in my life.
Oh, yeah. It was unbelievable. Sean had made a dish. It was a soft shell crab, and it was sitting in a Benton's bacon dashi or broth. And I can remember it, the look, how it tasted, everything about it to this day. It was really eye-opening to see, you know, a hillbilly product like we make used in such a unique way.
I remember just as vividly the first time I tasted Benton's bacon in that fancy soup in Atlanta 15 years ago. In the years following, Stacy and I got to taste it occasionally when we were out for dinner where a chef was using it in a dish. And after a while, I started thinking how wonderful it might be to just have some in my own kitchen to fry up for breakfast with some scrambled eggs. So I got on the Benton's website and I put in the minimum order, 4 pounds. Getting a Benton's bacon delivery gives you an experience you might never have thought possible. To walk out to your mailbox, open it, and be completely overwhelmed with the delicious aroma of bacon. Now, of course, that's nothing compared to the smell of that bacon cooking in my own skillet. And I now enjoy that on the regular. But preparing this show for y'all gave me the first chance I'd had to visit the Bentons up in Tennessee. And here's a secret. If you go up there yourself, you will find products for sale that are not available on the website because of shipping challenges, like country sausage, you know, the kind that you make into patties and cook for sausage biscuits. I did come home with a little of that sausage. Stacy made biscuits, and Lord have mercy, the result was incredible. But the best thing I came home with was the lesson that a time-worn traditional preservation method, born of the needs of Southerners who were just struggling to feed their families, can attract the attention of the fanciest people in New York or Los Angeles or Seattle, and that the repeated actions required to maintain that method have the power to bring people home, to make a family closer.
Sometimes your calling changes. Mine did, and coming back into the business has been a great change in more ways than one. During my childhood, I didn't get much time with my father. Since I'm back, I get to see him every day. It's kind of like a second chance catching up on some of that, and I think we both enjoyed it. And it's also given me more time and flexibility with my own two young children.
Would Aristotle call that virtuous? Probably so. We'd like to thank Alan and Darryl Benton for their hospitality when we visited them. They are both good-hearted mountain people, like the kind I grew up with. Also, I should thank Chef Linton Hopkins here in Atlanta for making my discovery of Benton's bacon possible all those years ago. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Every Friday, we add a new 3-minute commentary about Southern stuff to our podcast feed, And every month or so, we add longer deluxe stories such as the one we've just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, an online magazine where you can find Southern stories told in every possible form, 24/7 at salvationsouth.com. Our producer is the mighty Jake Cook, who also composed our theme music. GPB's director of podcasts is Jeremy Powell. And none of this could have happened without wonderful people like GPB's Sandy Malcolm, Adam Woodleaf, and Bert Wesley Huffman. We'll be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast.